This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. Welcome to the show, everybody. My name is Michael Shaw, and this is a best of episode with ArtNet writer and author of 9.5 Theses on Art and Class, Ben Davis. This is a rerun of episode 138, all the way back from a little over 5 years ago, May of 2016. I'm putting this episode out instead of a fresh one because I am about to go out of town and wanted to take the opportunity to dive into the archive. And big thanks to listener and friend of the show, Julie Nelson, for providing me with a list of her top picks. She's listened to the whole catalog, I believe, and she gave me a solid list among which there were many writers and from which I selected this one. So I will give you an update, though, a fresh update on Ben. He had some things to say to me. He has a new book coming out. Thank you to those of you who continue to support the show month by month on Patreon. If you would like to join them, go to theconversationpod.com/support. If you would like to get involved in shaping future episodes of this podcast and you're interested in or open to volunteering a few hours a week of your time, please do get in touch. We could use some extra hands right now. Just shoot me a note, theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. So now let me just tell you what Ben had to say, and then we will jump into this long but worthy and thought-provoking episode. So he's just finished a new book called Culture Collapse that touches on some or all of what we talked about, essentially how cultural categories and art systems have imploded or flattened in the last 10 years in various ways, and how to think about those questions of problems politically. The prompt I gave him is, how do you think about activism and or art and activism differently than you did 5 years ago? And he said, I'd say, and I say this at greater length in Culture Collapse, that my thoughts about art and activism haven't changed much, but the situation has changed dramatically, which means new thoughts. A major part of my analysis is that artists lean anarchists when they radicalize because of the nature of what art making is socially and economically. So I think the recent past has gotten more radical, but also more anarchic, even when people don't have a name for it. I'm sympathetic to anarchists, but I am not an anarchist. I am a socialist. As institutions break down and radicalization continues apace, I think it will be important to talk about what the differences between radical traditions are and what that means and how artists might relate to institutions and movements and political strategies. The unionization at museums is the most hopeful thing in the recent art past. In addition, because art felt small but politics felt big in the recent past, people came to view arts and culture writing as advocacy writing for a cause, and as a result, it has been, it seems to me, a dramatic loss of ability to talk about the autonomous aesthetic dimensions of work in favor of the ethical or moral, even when people don't admit out loud that that is what they are doing. It's one part of what culture collapse means to me. This concerns me politically. It produces a level of closed thought where you can no longer see whether a message is composed in such a way that people outside of a tight circle actually like it because you are judging it on intentions. And it concerns me artistically just in that I don't want to give up the pleasures associated with non-political aspects of art to conservatives or right-wingers. And now, finally, just to say, is a scary and in some ways despairing time, but it's been an exciting few years, too. I feel that though my convictions are the same, I also feel that there is more and more to learn, more and more to keep up with, and people doing inspiring stuff, and that's exciting. All right, so here we go with Ben Davis from 2016. Happy late July to you, and I will talk to you again in August. Hope you're doing well. Ciao for now. Your trip. How was your trip to Australia?
Oh, excellent. You know, it's a long trip. You're going down to the literal other side of the world. And it was a busy trip, both because I was working for the first half of it. I mean, I took half of the trip as a vacation because otherwise it wouldn't really make sense to go give one lecture for one day. When the flight is 28 hours. But no, it is very exciting. I think the actual conference was interesting, which is unusual for art conferences. mm-hmm. is about art and the connected future and the future of the museum. And I think the discussion was interesting, and I got a lot out of just collecting my thoughts about the subject.
Mm.
And then sort of I met a lot of really interesting Australians, and I did an interview for work with an Australian artist named Ben Quilty, who's a painter who also has been doing solidarity work with immigrants in Europe. So he went to Lesbos with an Australian author to write who wrote an account for The Guardian about the situation they saw there, and he did some sketches of the people that they met. And so very interesting artists doing very, I think, important work. And we got a chance to meet up in Sydney, and he introduced me to a bunch of other, sort of opened a section of the art world there to me that seemed very exciting to explore.
Mm. And when you say he's doing interesting work, are you talking about both the artwork that he makes and the social activism that he's doing?
Well, I think it's really the way those two things fit together that I find interesting,
mm.
you know? And so, and the entire kind of conversation coming out of it about, you know, what it means to be an artist at this moment, when confronted with something like what's happening in North Africa and Europe, with the refugee crisis. I mean, that's just such an immense question that when you start pulling on that thread, you know, it just raises a lot of questions, and it's like you could go crazy trying to think about what you need, how to respond to something like that. So
yeah.
the entire, you know, the way he's approaching it, I think is inspiring and important.
Mm-hmm. And what you're talking about, the fitting those two things together, is I believe one of the subtexts or threads running through your book, among others.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've written a lot about art and activism, and that seems to be, as I've traveled and talked about my book, seems to be something that people sort of seize onto as something that they want to talk about. I mean, I think mm-hmm. that in general, people want to feel like what they're doing, not all people, but I mean, I think that this is a conversation that a lot of people are having, you know. What does it mean to make work, artwork that is meaningful in this moment? And people, the answers aren't always clear. So I feel you get a lot of searching questions about, you know, what's the formula, you know, that connects this circuit between
right.
art and politics.
Right. And speaking of questions, because before we get too deep into the heavier stuff, I do want to go back to where I started about your trip.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, and this is will be sort of a starting point to ask you about your book tour, as it were, your travels related to your book. So were you brought down there kind of as, you know, as an art critic known for something related to the subject matter, or Ben Davis is this guy who wrote this 9.5 theses on art in class, and so he would fit into this, or what? What do you think their reasoning was for inviting you?
I don't know, Michael. I don't know. You know, it's hard to judge from New York how they see you in Melbourne, and I met up with some activists down there, some immigrant rights and labor activists, and we were talking about my book at a little study group we did at a community center the first night I was there, and you know, those are people who are embedded in the political scene, and we're talking about, you know, real activism that they're doing, and they were just completely perplexed by reading my book, and then you know, going to the I was at the National Gallery of Victoria, which is something like doing a a big program at the MoMA or LACMA, and they just were like, what do you think they're expecting from you at this conference? So I don't know. I mean, I think in essence, I have written, this was keyed to a panel about Andy Warhol and, or a show, a big show they have there about Andy Warhol and Ai Weiwei. So mm-hmm. because of Ai Weiwei's international image, there is an activist component. And then I have written a bit about art and technology and art and its relationship to the internet and the digital. So then that was the subject of the right. panel. But you know, what exact combination of ingredients they were looking for is a little bit mysterious to me.
Well, you made it down there in any case. You were there. And aside from your vacation, which I could ask you about at some point, by the way, I guess just we don't have to dive too deep into what it was like being in Australia or being a part of this panel, but in connection with your other presentations or some panels that you've been on, was there a notable difference, you know, audience-wise, would you say, or just the fact that you were down in Australia, or how would you put it?
Well, I mean, more, I think, notable similarities. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've toured with my book or traveled in the years since my book has come out. One of the things that I've thought about is, you know, how not New York centric necessarily the book is, but how informed it is by my placement in New York and the kind of questions that that very specific environment raises. And, you know, things look, the conversation looks a little bit different everywhere you go. Mm. And it is different in Australia, but it is also somehow kind of both frustrating, but also affirming to see that artists, art workers, people, museum folks are kind of wrestling with a lot of the same questions.
I think the subtext of my question about the event there is what you're, I mean, if I think you sort of answered it already, which is that each location and each lecture you give or panel that you're on is a little bit similar and a little bit different, I guess. But you, one of your greatest anecdotes in your book, which I would like us to visit, and either you can read it or I can read it because I think it's worthy of that. I just want to know if that, because it's an anecdote that resonates or is familiar from other books about the art world. And I just want to know if, and this is the one about where in 2007 you spoke on a panel about contemporary art. This one, do you remember this one?
Okay, yeah, sure.
Do you want to read it or you want me to? Is it pedantic if either of us reads this? Is that what you're getting at?
No. Go for it. I mean, you're talking about, I'm on a panel. Someone raises their hand and says, you know, don't artists have a moral...
ethical responsibility.
Responsibility in order to produce their own work.
Exactly.
And, it leaves me thinking, you know, like... and I respond to that, and then, you know, everybody is... the outrage ensues.
Yeah, that's maybe a little more sensational than the way you actually originally put it.
I give my modest, what I think is modest defense of a kind of open-minded, pluralistic defense.
It was very, sort of articulate, you know, way of sort of dodging that train. And yet after you were very happily made your response, 20 other hands went up in the audience. That was the image that I really loved. And so I'm just wondering, you know, if you feel sometimes that the Q&As that you're involved with are overly weighted with, you know, these kinds of conservative queries, if you will.
Not really. I mean, I think it there are many art worlds, you know, and it is it's confusing. You drop through into one conversation and suddenly realize that, you know, things you take for granted as a baseline level of artistic part of the, being part of the artistic conversation, like, are just not there. You know, there's actually kind of these mutually incompatible art tribes. So there mm-hmm. are the academics and the brainiacs who are embedded in a very specific conversation that almost doesn't touch with, I don't know, the people who are the traditionalist crowd, the Upper East Side crowd.
Right.
And that almost doesn't touch the market people in some sense.
Right.
I mean, there are people who are just completely embedded in the market conversation and the art fair conversation. And then there's like the entire, you know, entire parallel universe of the social practice scene, which has become a huge parallel art world with its own stars and its own debates and its own problematics. So it's a kind of a constant bobbing and weaving, you know, where you have to, I think, be very careful how you frame questions as you, how you frame yourself, your arguments as you're making them, because, mm-hmm. You know, what could sound really, radical in one place sounds like really conservative in another,
mm-hmm.
Just depending on the references people have.
Right, right. Yeah, gotcha. Well, what are, I mean...
And just to add, it's like, sure. really disorienting, I think, how, you know, it's kind of like the blind man feeling the elephant, you know, where, and I talk about that a little bit in another chapter in the book as well, where, you know, everybody has a different idea of what's wrong with the art world, you know, that
right.
the people who are committed to a certain kind of traditionalism will say, well, the problem is it's all radical chic and politics, you know. And the people who are invested in political practice will say, well, the problem is it's like all commercial and there's no politics. And somehow mm-hmm. all these things are true at once. So that's mm-hmm. a very disorienting landscape to navigate as well.
Yeah, indeed. Well, this book was published in 2013, and thank you for your copy and for signing it, by the way. I'm cherishing your signed copy.
Oh, of course. I'm glad to get it out there.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was published in 2013, so it's a few years later, and I don't know if I'm under the misunderstanding that you've kind of been doing – I mean, you just – let me put it this way. When we first connected, you were about to come to LA to do a presentation at the Hammer. That was definitely in some connection to your book, correct?
Well, I mean, I have a job as an art critic for ArtNet News, which is a large art website. And my title there is National Art Critic, so I'm supposed to be traveling, although it's not always, you know, things are busy. But I do think, and some of the essays in the book are things that I published years ago,
right.
an old version of ArtNet magazine, where
right.
I worked for 5 years. But the book, it's just funny the way... information circulates in different ways, and that for all people talking about how, you know, the internet is consuming everything and becoming the standard by which information circulates, you know, putting these essays into this book and it just circulates in such a different way. People take me so much more seriously, and I think it sort of dropped at a important moment and found an audience of people who were looking to have the conversation that it began. So, and that has, you know, brought me to different places to talk about the various parts of the argument, including Down Under recently.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about putting out a book like this. And, you know, regardless of when it came out, or the fact that you had some very old for you pieces that were included in it, is that it's the kind of thing, and it's accessible enough that enough people can read it, and you know, people want to talk about these things. It's in a very universal way. It's very different than an artist, you know, putting out a monogram, or you know, or even a maybe more literary book and touring with that, because it's only about them. This is about everything related to the art world and beyond. So I don't know if that's too much lead in, but so I'm curious, you know, from having traveled around with it, or just with your National Art Critic title, what some of the takeaways have particularly stood out for you as far as, you know, memorable exchanges or conversations or what have you?
Memorable conversations or exchanges traveling on the book. Well, I mean, I've spoken about the book at both in art venues and like in a number of sort of more political conferences, like the Left Forum here in New York. And one of the things that I really ended up realizing, this is in the book, but just the experience sort of confirms it and amplifies what I think about it, is that I'll give these talks. People always want to talk about art and politics. This kind of boilerplate, you know, panel discussion title. And so I'll give a talk or my stump speech about the subject, about, you know, how museums function in the economy and how artists how artists function as actors within society. And then the question and answer period will come around and a dozen hands go up again. And the first person will say, well, what about quilting? You know, and the next person will say, well, what about hip hop? And I really realized that there's this problem, is that, you know, panels on art and politics, or the way we talk about art, you know, is, I guess in jargon you'd call it an idealist concept, you know, this kind of abstraction that's gotten away from its subject matter and kind of functions to blur lines. So one of the specific projects of the book is to kind of clarify this question, I mean, about specifically regarding visual arts, you know, like, because I think the theoretical discussion, even the practical discussion, in my experience teaching, gets lost in the weeds a little bit of this, anything can be art, you know, because art's a very pluralistic thing. But there are like real specific things we mean when we talk about visual art. And then the visual art conversation has very specific coordinates and parameters. And, you know, the entire way, you know, the question of painting in politics is very different than the question of documentary film or Hollywood, you know, political readings of Hollywood movies or theater, the Broadway stage and politics, or hip hop and politics. They all have like very different coordinates. So I thought a lot more about the specificity of my own argument based on conversations that have come out of the discussions of the books. That's one thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what's the other?
Oh, the other. yeah, it's not enough for you.
No. Well, I'm sorry. Let me just. I just don't want to shut this train down. You describe one aspect of the group conversations or the Q&As or the panel discussions that you've had where people are sort of feverish to talk about art and politics, you know, and they say things like you describe, you know, what about quilting, what about hip-hop, etc. So that's one thing that really has stuck with you. Maybe what is there another one that really comes to mind?
Well, I mean, the other way the thoughts in the book have developed, I guess, and this is one of the things I said before that, you know, kind of realizing some of the restrictions of having, of being based in New York is,
right,
as you travel with it, I realized that, you know, outside of New York, in places where the market is not as present,
right,
that the social practice conversation almost is the art conversation. And that changes the argument a little. So I've written, after, you know, post 9.5 thesis at art in class, I've written a bit more about how you can take this argument and, you know, port it into that conversation about social practice. I mean, I think that we're both like in a politically turbulent moment where people are looking around to figure out how they can change the world or be artists in meaningful conversation, but also because there's so little support for the arts in the United States, that the way that people are able to think about themselves as a professional artist is in relationship to grant funders or nonprofits or, mm-hmm, or different kinds of community organizations that all have their art funding tied to community impact mm-hmm, metrics. And that produces a sort of natural push towards art as community engagement. And that's, I think, the other basis for the social practice explosion. And another way, I mean, and is another permutation of how this kind of my idea of the artist as the middle class creative laborer plays out within the broader art conversation. And that's something that's certainly, it's not like that conversation doesn't exist in New York, but you know that the proportion that it exists in has changed outside of New York, which changes the entire flavor of things.
Mm. I've read it, that term, by the way, as social aesthetics as well. Are you okay with
what?
That? Social aesthetics.
Oh, social aesthetics.
And I'll tell you why.
I've heard that.
And I'll tell you why I like that better. Because the word practice, my listeners are either laughing or I don't know what they're doing.
I know
right now.
It's
my pet peeve word. Yes,
your pet peeve.
Exactly. I think practice is an incredibly overused word in the art context, and I could go on, but you know, you're not really practicing something. You're doing something. I actually had a brief conversation with a Mexican artist and who's involved with a big program down there. And I was trying to ask her from a language perspective if it meant the word practice or like art practice meant something different. And I tried to explain, you know, what my concerns were. And she said, well, I said, like, use the word work. And she said, no, the work is when it's finished. When you're practicing is when you're working on it. So I don't know.
I like your term social aesthetics.
Good. Thank you.
In a sense, in that I think that the putting practice in there is a way to kind of indicate that it's exited art and is, you know, down in the shit, rolling up
right,
its sleeves and getting stuff done. Whereas I actually think that a lot of the problems of aestheticizing politics are still there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bad idea to just like highlight the problems so that you can address them if they can be addressed.
Yeah. And I think aesthetics actually, and disagree with me if you feel so, but I think another reason aesthetics and social aesthetics works is because you really are being upfront about the fact that there is a connection to art and aesthetics, as opposed to just social organizing. And that kind of leads me to the question that's been on my mind for the last couple minutes is, you know, I wonder if this is something that's come up in some of your conversations in the past. What is the case to be made? And this is, I know, a very simplistic way of putting it, but what is the case to be made for being involved and committed to social aesthetics as opposed to just being involved in community organizing or politics or activism, you know, full stop, you know, as opposed to, well, I, you know, I'm an artist, you know, and I have creative urges, you know, so I need to reconcile my creative urges and who I am as a creative person and an artist with my social activism.
Well, I mean, I think the better people, I think that the better people involved in social practice would deny that there's a difference between, you know, they wouldn't say, they would say that they are involved in organizing or community organizing, and they're just looking for ways that to use the creative, to leverage, better leverage the creative component of that. There's something to that. I mean, there's no, there's enough problems in this world to go around. So
yeah,
I don't,
that's,
you know,
true.
If people want to become involved with them, I don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth. But on the other hand, there are very real pitfalls, dilemmas, and debates there, and political pitfalls. Because the way I see it, you know, specifically if you kind of move too quickly over the tension between the artistic side and the plain Jane organizing part, because you know, I was at last year at the Creative Times Open Engagement conference, and there was someone there from the Seattle city government, which apparently has a social practice component, or they've worked supportive artistic community projects into the apparatus of city government. And we were in a discussion period after one of the sessions, and she said, raised her hand and said, you know, I just want to ask this question, because how do people deal with this? Because on the one hand, this is a great thing, and we're capable of doing great things. But on the other hand, there's this constant pressure from the people who back this to say, well, look, there are these people over there. They're really angry. Can you just do some kind of creative thing to distract them a little?
Mm-hmm.
And that is a real thing. That is, this stuff is being instrumentalized. And is not always virtuous by design. So I think it's just really important to keep a critical perspective on it.
Mm. So the political artist's dream job to be a distractor in situations like these with their creative interventions.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly. Those jobs exist.
Are they paid?
You know, are embedded in all the power structures that make them exist. So, you know, I see it very much within the framework, the class framework, which I lay out in the book, which we haven't gone into so far in this conversation, but you know, essentially I argue that there are from a Marxist framework, there are different ways that people relate to their labor. And
right,
there's like the classic working class way, which is that you sell your labor to somebody and you don't have a say over it, over what the content of it, because you've sold it in exchange for a wage. And then there's what in the framework would have been called the petit bourgeois or middle class way, which is where you own a small business or a small practice and you do what you want with it, and then you get to find buyers at a later stage for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you look at the creative sphere, you can see that there are lots of creative work that's done in a purely working class way, in that sense where you it's work for hire. You know, if you're a graphic designer or a cinematographer working on a film or so on, you have parameters that people give you, and then you're paid in order to hit them in various degrees of rigor. And then the visual arts version of this is very quirky, you know, in our world, because, and I think that's why people are romanticize being a visual artist, is because you get to do what you want. You have control over your labor, and then you make a living off of that, mm-hmm. you know, in some kind of way that is often kind of illusory, but that's the fantasy of it. So I think the social practice, point being, the social practice thing still fits that pattern. I mean, people are looking for fulfilling creative work,
right,
that fulfills, that contributes to a project that they feel a part of, and it fits into the same pattern, only in a slightly altered version, but it's, you know, it's fraught with its own kind of tensions.
Mm. Well, you mentioned, you know, sort of almost parenthetically or briefly in parts of the book, your own sort of political involvement, including Occupy and, you know, at least a few other things. And I guess I wonder if those kinds of activities are the part of Ben that, you know, sort of an extracurricular part of your life, and that the art world or the art criticism work is your professional life, you know what I mean? And the way, the sort of larger framework that I'm asking that within is artists making work that, and you kind of write about this in a different way, but artists making work that is very much within the stream or bubble of the art world or of the art context. You talk about this in many different ways, but I guess I'm trying to set up the question at least with enough framework that includes, you know, you, the individual, and, you know, your two separate tracks.
Well, I think it's important to have a political life outside of the art world. Yeah, I guess I'm an arts professional, and I'm actually very, very lucky as a writer.
Yeah.
To have the platform I have and the success that I've had. I mean, that's not a usual position.
Indeed.
for writers. I mean, they're just very, the space of success is very small,
right?
So I mean, I don't think I can deny that I am a part of this world, and there are lots of good people who are, but it is, yes, it is my position, both kind of theoretically and just in my life, that I don't think that that's, in some sense, I don't think that's the most important piece either of art or of politics. You know, I mean, I think that the meaningful political developments are sadly not going to come about through museum shows and panel discussions at art spaces, but are going to come out through social movements that are outside of those spaces, and possibly at times even antagonistic to them. Mm-hmm. And but also, in a similar way, the truth is, I think that you know, not even all the good art is in that space. You know, I mean, most of what's really exciting about art is kind of, you know, underground and non-professional and weird and not really what you get talked about in the art magazines, I don't think.
Are you covering that work?
Am I?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I don't know. I mean, I am, I have a job which has a certain quid pro quo that I have to cover. I mean, if there's a Jeff Koons show, I have to cover that. It can be a negative opinion, but I have to have an opinion about that. And it's an effort to that requires like personal, like you know, it requires making a case to your editor. It requires carving out time around the other demands, which publishing is like very demanding right now. It requires, but yeah, I mean, I do my best. But last year, I think the best thing I wrote last year is I took a personal vacation to go to Greece, because it's like it's obviously a very intense and time in Greece, and I wanted to see if there were artists there who had learned lessons, who were responding in meaningful ways, and I found some of that in the short time that I was there, and sort of renewed my faith in a lot of ways that this stuff isn't all just kind of some kind of silly conversation we're having with ourselves, pretending that it's more important than it is.
Right. Well, what are some other, we can bypass your editor right now. We can talk about another couple of, are there any, you mentioned the, you know, things that are underground and weird. What are some things that come to mind maybe that more recently that you maybe don't necessarily or won't necessarily have the opportunity to write about that, you know, whether it's one artist, whether it's a group?
Well, I mean, I'm going to try and write about, everything goes into, that's an important part of the project for me. I was just in Australia, and there was a woman, who's on a panel with me named Fee Plumley, who, really amazing figure who was high up in the Australian Arts Funding Council and a pioneer of digital mobile art, and then like art on mobile phones, and then became totally disillusioned with that, both the arts and the technology conversation, because both seemed pretty compromised, sort of dropped out of the scene, and now lives in Adelaide in a bus and is creating these installations that are about silence, you know, that are about experiencing silence, connecting with silence. Mm-hmm. And this has been something that I've been thinking about a lot. So it was like amazing to meet an artist who has kind of like lived something that you've been just piecing together intellectually. And yeah, I think that's an amazing, and was the person who was like bringing up the most spirited kind of political points on the in the discussion at the NGV in Melbourne.
What have you been thinking about silence?
Well, I mean, it's sort of the next sort of big text that I'm working on that came out of the conversation in Australia about the Museum of the Future, what the Museum of the Future will look like. And there's this huge converging consensus that the Museum of the Future will be digital, and that will be about immersive installation design. And I was just in San Francisco, where Pace Gallery has opened a new space called Pace Art and Technology. It has this Japanese group, Team Lab, which is 400, you know, it's a company of 400 people who make these really sophisticated immersive light installations that are interactive and look like paintings, where these very detailed animations that respond to you. And it's almost just interactive design. Like, there's almost doesn't need the apparatus of art. You don't have to know anything about an individual's personality or struggles or symbolism in order to respond to it. And it kind of becomes part of this kind of general digital culture. And I have this big concern that, you know, if that's the way art culture goes, I'm not sure not sure it needs either art critics or artists, really. It just becomes more or less like theme parks. So in that context, I mean, I think there's a space to recuperate the idea of art as a kind, as something that's unplugged, and the silence of art, the fact that it, the traditional media of art emerged in sort of different, have a different pace to them than the constantly responsive digital entertainment that people are immersed in. And there's a chance to recuperate that and maybe even politicize that discussion. And that's what I'm working on right now. So, you know, there are a couple pieces of that argument that still need to be built, but I think it's an interesting conversation that's developing right now. That obviously, you know, this woman I met in Australia, Fee Plumley, reads as this total prophecy of that to me, because she was a pioneer in a way of thinking about what it would mean to have art in your pocket and with your mobile phone everywhere you went. And then she sort of followed that thought along to its limit. And now she's arrived at a very different place in the outback.
Right. You know, when you're obviously talking about silence in the larger metaphorical sense, but I have to admit that I thought you were talking about when you first mentioned the word that maybe, you know, you living in New York and, you know, what with cosmopolitans the way they are these days, that maybe you just needed to, you know, have what are those called? Those, chambers? Sensory deprivation chambers, you know.
Well, those metropolitans. Well, it's kind of unconnected, you know. The thing is, this is a conversation that it's not even really an art conversation. I mean, adult coloring books are a huge bestseller.
Right,
you know?
That's an interesting topic.
It's a huge, you know, there is a huge feeling of anxiety and angst about how connected everything has become. I think it's also, if you follow it through to its completion, it's like a political conversation, because those spaces, our social networks and our mobile devices, are corporate and advertising driven and based around planned obsolescence, because they've got to sell you new things constantly. So there is there's like political energy to be activated there, but I mean, I think we all need a break. And as a writer, you know, I've only ever worked for online publications, and I've only ever seen, as I've become more successful, as my career has developed, counterintuitively, maybe, I have to work harder and harder and harder, because 10 years ago, the publication I worked for, you had to publish one piece a month, maybe, do a bunch of editing on top of that, but basically one piece a month. And now the junior writers have to publish 5 pieces a day. So that's just a completely different tempo, completely different pressure, completely different demands, and much more challenging environment to develop a kind of thought about anything you're writing about. And so, yeah, I think there's a real value in the idea of figuring out how to carve out spaces within that for reflection, mm-hmm. that sounds kind of like bougie, but and it is, in the sense that that kind of privilege, the privilege of being unplugged, is increasingly something that's a luxury that people buy into, you know, the quiet car kind of effect. And I think probably it's something that we'll be fighting for, you know.
So your job then is sort of forcing you to be more connected than ever, and so why, which is making you in turn want to become more disconnected than ever?
I think that is not just me. I think that's lots of people, and not just media people either. I mean, I think that's just the reality of work in the 21st century is this sort of
sure.
constant connection and redirection and all this and constant just in time kind of delivery of
right
of things. So yeah,
right. Yeah, got it. Well, let's maybe we should dig into some sections of your book. And I'm a little overwhelmed with where to start, but I do have a couple things at the top, so maybe we'll start there. I like the phrase or the two word pairing trickle down is really important, I think. And so I'm going to quote from page 78. You say, in an era of trickle down economics, policies that favor the rich have caused massive redistribution of wealth to the top. This, in turn, creates giant amounts of surplus wealth that can be channeled into art. And so, as income for average families has stagnated and inequality has soared, there has also been an unprecedented expansion of the art market, which is all very obvious, but not uninteresting, just because it's obvious. And I think
it's more obvious now than it is when I wrote that.
Exactly.
I think that conversation has developed and become part of the common income, partly because of Occupy Wall Street.
Right.
And you know, it's the conversation has been a huge factor in this election. But I think that, you know, I don't know that the lines were so clearly drawn between the increase in inequality and the fact that I – point I'm making there, which is that, you know, the number one predictor of how the health of the art market is inequality, it wasn't a point in common discussion at that time. I mean, Andrea Fraser did a project of the Whitney Biennial in, I think 2012, I'm not sure, but where she like made this point as part of her intervention into the biennial, and it was a new piece she was adding to the conversation at that time.
Right. Yeah, and the trickle down, though, the reason, it's a twofold reason that I use that quote, because for me, I wonder what your thoughts are about trickle down in terms of art, you know, mm-hmm. and art in politics. And maybe this is an idea that, you know, in various forms comes up over and over again, maybe not. But I think one necessary question regarding whether it's outright political art or whether it's just art is to what extent you think that it trickles down, and that is to say sort of spreads throughout the culture, either as far as it being a political message that becomes more easily digestible, or, you know, whether it's art having some kind of maybe, I mean, I want to sort of adjust course in the middle of my sentence and say, well, art, when it becomes mainstream, it becomes fashion, you know. And if you look at the most recent New York Times Magazine, there is a Vuitton ad for that features a Vanessa Beecroft installation, right? You know, so you can take that however you want, but I think that's a question that.
Well, okay. I mean, I think let me just rephrase what you're saying. You're talking about the message of art, how that trickles down into society, correct?
Yeah. I in other words. What are the effects of art? In other words, one really simplistic way of putting it is art made, consumed, you know, and shat out only in the bubble, never to leave it? Or does it somehow, in some shape or form, permeate into the larger culture beyond that bubble?
Well, again, this is a place where that question about, you know, what do we mean by art start to become really important, because if you just say, does art affect the world? Of course it does. I mean, creativity is a really important part of why people get up every morning and struggle through the day, is, you know, to just have that one moment at the end of it where they get to unplug and consume some piece of entertainment, or to like have their own moment where they can be creatively fully active, you know, to have their piece of the creative conversation in their basement or in their studio or at an open mic or wherever. That is a huge part of people's lives, and in that sense, you know, it's just the most general and human thing is art, is creativity. But that's a separate question than the professional art world, you know, how that impacts the world. And I think that becomes a lot more complicated, tricky, and difficult, partly because of this economic conversation that you started with, which how entrapped all of our institutions of art are with that economic reality, that more and more things are at the mercy of the very, very wealthy institutions or individuals, the winners of our particular new gilded age. And that means that it is, I think, more and more difficult to fight for a meaningful space of political engagement within those spaces.
Yeah.
I think also in terms of then relating that, the two conversations about how, you know, trickle down economics and then trickle down aesthetics, I would say that they're sort of linked by the idea of individualism, that one of the things about the artistic identity, the class identity artist, is that it's very individualistic, because you have your own signature, your own creative practice, your own world thing you're doing. And if you can take politics and turn it into like your individual brand, that I'm gonna make a statement about neoliberalism or capitalism within the framework of this museum space that's given to me, and that's where the conversation ends, that's a very useful way for society to kind of bottle up that conversation and cage it. And it's not that threatening to the people who are criticized in a way, in general. I mean, there are cases when, that becomes a very volatile conversation. But actually, you know, if the crooked dealers of the world and the robber barons of our day can pose next to an artist who is making critical work, that makes them look good. You know, that's actually one of the classical roles that art fills politically, is kind of reputation laundering. I support critical dialogue about these things. And in that sense, I mean, I think there's a tight connection between that trickle-down economic mentality and the trickle-down art mentality in that it doesn't really trickle down.
Right.
You know, it benefits the individual artists who get tapped in order to make this kind of work. But, you know, very, very little of that conversation escapes that space into the more, the places where it might be a little more unnerving.
What do you mean by that, where it might be more unnerving?
Politically unnerving, to, you know, politically more distress, you know, might have more meaningful effects, I guess.
Mm-hmm. One of your theses, of your 9.5 theses, is 8.6, which says...
Well, can I just say, I mean,
oh, yeah.
Just since the people listening to the podcast might not know, the 9.5 Theses in Art and Class is a pamphlet I wrote a few years ago that was for an art show about art and class. It was an intervention into that art show here in New York.
Right.
And it's a set of numbered theses, statements, propositions, theoretical propositions about how artists relate to class. So
Right. You're
about to quote one of them. I just...
Yeah, no, thank you for
what that means is important.
Thank you for the setup. I don't have to do it in the introduction now. So 8.6 is, this is getting towards the end. Yeah, and by the way, I'll add briefly that they're very dense. It took me quite a while to get through all of them because I wanted to sort of, you know, be sure that I consume or that I digested each one.
It's a compressed format. That's the power of that text, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, became almost immediately, and was not published. It was just a pamphlet that I passed out. It became, you know, took on a life of its own, and, you know, it was translated into Spanish and Romanian and went on a website connected with the Occupy Wall Street, and it was critiqued before it was published. You know, people were writing essays against it. It's a funny thing because it is a dense text and in a way that's I think sort of part of its power because it packs a lot.
Yeah.
Those exactly. 5 pages or whatever.
Exactly. It's like eating, you know, rich to dense food. You know, you can only eat a little bit at a time. That was my experience. In any case, 8 points.
My editor said you can't lead with that text. It has to be chapter two.
Right. Yeah, got it. Haymarket Books. So 8.6 reads, contemporary art suffers from a narrow audience. Access to art education is largely and increasingly determined by income level and privilege. Art education should be defended and made universal. And then in parentheses, this point itself involves a critique of the notion that art is a luxury. Now, the reason that I bring that up is because in our just prior, your discussion or addressing of, you know, trickle down, both economics and art, you mentioned that very visual image of the creative impulse that people have, you know, and they're coming home. They live for that moment in the day where they get to, you know, jam in the basement or consume entertainment or, you know, work on their creative project or whatever. And I wonder why even contemporary art education is necessary in light of that framework, you know, that people already are able to address their creative impulses in numerous ways. What do they need contemporary art for?
Well, I don't know if they necessarily need contemporary art as we think of it now, because contemporary art is a sort of luxury, intellectual luxury commodity. I think the idea of truly universal art education actually changes what we mean by contemporary art. People are creative and amazing. Like, it always amazes me the things people get up to, despite, you know, all the drama and struggles of living. People find a way to be really excitingly eccentrics as well. But look, I mean, there's resource questions, right? I mean, it's not that everybody gets to be creative equal or has equal access or is equally empowered. You know, if you think about just how beaten down people are, you know, in it actually, people benefit. I mean, I believe in teaching. People benefit from resources made available to them, having people who care about art, who've studied, have knowledge of what's come before and how the tools work, and like offering that knowledge to people. I think there's, you know, that is a benefit. There's an excellent essay out of Chicago called The Quiet Assassination of Gallery 55. I think that's what it's called. I could be getting the name right, which talks about, because of budget cuts, this celebrated Chicago program for young artists is on the chopping block.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really moving essay where they bring in painters and dance choreographers and creative experts to work with high school kids. And the author talks about, you know, what a great success it's had in transforming the lives of young people, disadvantaged young people, and, you know, sending them on to art careers, but also just about her own experience and saying, you know, like, look, I was a troubled kid, you know, and I think she talks about how she was cutting herself, you know, and I didn't feel normal or right, and I didn't feel like people heard my voice or that I had anything to say. And then I got put in this program, and here was a place where someone said, it's okay to have your own weird way of doing stuff. You know, it's okay. These thoughts you're having have value. It's creative expression. And she says it saved her life. So I think that's, in some sense, that is such, in some ways, a much more meaningful conversation to me about art's place in society, that art and education piece, than a lot of our conversations about art in the market or, you know, obviously it's a more meaningful conversation than what happened at the art fair last year.
Right.
That's where this strange discipline, that strange subculture, really, of people who are interested in contemporary art, like meet something that's just titanic in its implications for how society works and how fair it is.
Well, speaking of the professional art world, we're coming up on Freeze Fair weekend and its satellites and whatnot. And you're obligated to go out of your job?
Yeah, that's part of the quid pro quo. So this week will be a lot of running around and trying to find things to write about within that crazy art fair world.
And will your lens be tilted, you know, based on some of the things that you talked about earlier as far as, you know, things that are a little underground, a little, you know, crazy, what have you? Or not necessarily?
There's not a lot of crazy underground at Freeze Art Fair. I mean,
you have to find the satellite fairs that's the funkiest of the bunch.
Well, I mean, it's the very first thing I covered already is the Portal Art Fair, which is an artist-run art fair, and a complete off-the-wall kind of affair. I advise going to it. You know, it's there's some funky stuff there, but you know, art fairs are so boring to write about at this point, specifically because I feel like I've written about them.
Sure.
From every perspective. I mean, I've written about them from a critical perspective, from the perspective of how they're destroying art. I've written about them from the counterintuitive recuperation. I've done creative writing projects that are about them just to try and make it more interesting for myself. I am at peace with it. I mean, it's not a pleasant thing. It is an important thing to understand because mm-hmm. it is a big venue that determines the way the public sees contemporary art, the way artists relate to contemporary art. It is, in some ways, the reality of contemporary art is that I think that the social piece of it is much more important than the objects or the ideas.
Right.
And you really see that they're affairs. And the thing that makes me at peace with it, though, is that, I mean, the way I've come to think about it is that it's kind of, there are always good things there.
Well, what is your sensibility, Ben?
What'd you say?
I said, what is your sensibility? Because you obviously, you know, you are able to bring a certain amount of objectivity to what you write about. I gathered that. But I'd be really curious to know if you would be willing to acknowledge certain sensibilities that you have as far as what you like.
Oh, what I like. Oh, my sensibility.
Yeah.
Irrespective, outside of the art fairs now.
Well, no. well, both. How about both? First one, then the other.
Well, I think it. Okay, so in terms of art fairs, I think it is indisputable that a certain kind of art reads best at an art fair. Basically, poppy stuff.
Right.
Big objects.
Right.
Things with mirrors and neon. If it's more of a historical work than like very known brands, you know, in a nutshell, my sensibility in an art fair is I try and like push against that, you know, find the things that are hidden in there. There is always stuff. There's mm-hmm. always stuff that if you don't catch it, if you don't catch it and document it, it'll vanish into some very wealthy person's den, never be seen from again.
Right.
So I do think there's something, you know, maybe not the most important thing in the world, but there's something worthy there in that being there and seeing those things before they vanish. And then in a more cosmic, you know, a bigger way, I try and be very ecumenical. Like I don't, I guess I have sort of a reputation of as a political art critic, but I am very supportive of political projects, but I think that there's a bigger meaning for art that's not just its propaganda value. So and my method is always to try and figure out what the artwork was trying to do inside of itself, you know, what its own promise was and whether or not it fulfills that promise. Cause I think that that's, imminent critique is the only honest way to approach contemporary art because it's so diverse.
Do you think you could flesh that out with any example that comes to mind? Because I hear that process of checking the artwork for its own objectives and whether they were met or not. But I kind of want to see that being played out a little bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, it never ceases to surprise me. I was in. When I was in Australia at this study group, one of the people who brought me there was showing me her art. And if I had just walked into the gallery and looked at it, I would have thought that it was a kind of meaningless abstraction. But she's from New Zealand, and it was this map of the New Zealand earthquake. That it was her mapping through a rigorous form of abstraction the that event, and that's just a very simple example of of you never know exactly what you're looking at, but yeah.
Do you have any inclination of where you'd like to go? I mean, I have one of the things was that the section where you talked about women in art, you know, and that challenge and kind of the sort of the back room, you know, scenario of how careers are made, which I think is very interesting. But, you know, I don't know if that's going to get off the spirit of what we've been talking about. So,
I mean, I don't think that, to me, all of these thoughts intersect. The section in the book, White Walls, Glass Ceiling, I wrote maybe is the oldest essay in the book. And I say this in a note at the end that, and it's sort of a belated echo of something that's historically true, which is that, you know, the feminist movement opened up questions that obviously were important for women, but also, you know, challenged a lot of other things that led to a lot of other conversations. And that it just, this question, which I considered an enigma at the time, how come is it that the majority of art students are women, but like two thirds, I think it is, but it's two thirds men in the art galleries. You know, what explains that?
Right.
Because you can say it's sexism, but I think that's a little bit, it's not specific enough in a way. Like you have to, because feminism is a part of the mainstream art discussion, and, so I guess I wanted to know, is it because it's like people are saying one thing and doing another, or is it because there are real chauvinists who have disproportionate power? You know, what is it that makes this that accounts for this the disproportion? And that process of kind of trying to answer that question for myself really begun the process of thinking more materially about what is the art world? Like, how does this thing work? You know, this is a machine that produces a certain kind of product, and how, what are the ingredients that go into that product? And it was that enigma that kind of triggered that. And for me, opened up opened my eyes to that problem and to a lot of others.
And it's really interesting to me the way that you found this anecdote or example in a book that this woman or show that this woman organized that was almost all men. And you know, and just the sort of the vibe of the way that all these guys had kind of connected, you know, were buddies and it was like an old boys club. It almost kind of, and this is something that came up in a conversation with a woman artist not too long ago, the idea of bro, you know, culture within the art world, you know, to the extent that guys can sort of more easily somehow bond with each other, you know, I don't know, in a bro-y art world version of the bro-y way. And somehow that is also inadvertently a kind of a careerist benefit as well. Does that kind of ring to you?
Yeah. I mean, bluster and bravado account for a lot. In some ways, if you're an artist, the product you're selling is yourself. And you ought to look like the arrogant genius that the people buying the art think an artist ought to look like.
Right.
And that probably looks more like a dude, given the realities of history.
Right.
Hopefully that's changing. I think that may be changing. But on the other hand, you know, it's a bro question, honestly, but it's not just that. Or, I mean, this is what I'm saying. It opens up my eyes on a whole other series of problems. So, for instance, I wrote another piece earlier this year called Do You Have to Be Rich to Make It as an Artist? And it's sort of following on from the conversation in the book. This is like where the conversation in the books have taken me since it was published.
Right.
And sort of thinking similarly, I just had this realization that if you count, if you aggregate the data, you know, of all the museum shows in New York, and you track down the New York Times profile of each artist, and then there'll always be a paragraph in there. It's usually about a paragraph where they briefly rush through the upbringing of the artist. And if you put that all together into a spreadsheet, what you would see is that by far the majority of artists come from a very, very, very similar social background.
Right.
That their parents are professionals, middle-class professionals. And there are exceptions to that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, the more common exception to that pattern is that they were just born very, very, very rich.
Right, I was going to say.
And
yeah.
It doesn't – the least common exception is that someone was poor or their parents were unprofessional workers and blue-collar workers, if you want to put it that way.
Right.
So that's the same – in a different register, that's the same bias. It interlocks with the questions of bias against women because, I mean, women make less money in their – in their non-art careers. You know, that's a statistical fact. So there's probably the economic questions of your background and how much resources you have to draw on relate to questions of gender as well and who can hang on to get that crucial show and stuff.
Yeah.
But, I mean, once you start thinking about, you know, what the culture of art actually represents, in terms of its demographics, in terms of the whiteness of the whole thing, disproportionate whiteness, and in terms of the socioeconomics, it's quite disheartening. You know, it really throws into relief how there's some really there's some stuff about how this works that we don't that we don't talk about, maybe we don't know how to talk about, that needs to be pulled out. For no other reason than because, you know, very, you know, hopeful young people are going through art, going into lots of debt with the idea of an art world that works in a certain way,
right,
when it actually works with all these shady mechanisms that we don't know how to talk about or are telling them about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder, you know, you I've been hearing, and I'm sure you are very aware as well, about the growth of academics, including how to make it as an artist, you know, curriculum in grad schools, you know, as of the last 5, maybe 10 years. And I wonder to what extent any of those programs do try to sort of grapple with the shady / you know, backroom / intangible type activities that go on, and how, you know, I mean, like there was that book, The Rules, you know, that actually in L.A., gallerist, I believe, wrote her version of The Rules several years ago. So there was that, right? But I wonder if, you know, do you try to educate people about these kinds of things, like your students, or do you have no idea what to tell them?
Well, I taught a class on my book, and
okay,
I found, yes, of course, I found that really depressed them.
Exactly.
I mean, it's definitely something. It's hard not to be talking yourself out of a job. I'm not saying you should do it. I'm just saying there actually is. Once you start that conversation,
right,
then you better believe in art as
right.
a vocation and
right.
be able to articulate that really well to these students. Because otherwise, you're basically saying, "I'm training you for a career that doesn't exist."
Right.
So you better have something to offer on the other hand, you know,
yeah, yeah.
Like nevertheless, it has this really important role in society and you are gonna, you are part of that, a conversation that matters a heck of a lot. And if you don't have that and you just have a kind of general idea that art's like a interesting world to be associated with, then that conversation, it starts to be really dangerous because it will be this realistically, it will be the students who either roll the dice and they hit just right and they meet the right person who introduces them to the right person. And that is pure, that is a pure lottery. Mm. Or it will be the people who, through the luck of their, you know, their financial resources they happen to be gifted with,
right,
will be able to afford to have high-end, you know, editing equipment to edit their access to that in their studio in order to expensive editing equipment in order to make impressive looking films, and who will be able to buy tickets to the events where they will meet the people, those same people, and get access to the power players and sell themselves. You know, they're like really real financial constraints on who has access to these networks and who can afford to look like an artist in the sense that people are expecting an artist to look like.
And speaking of which, I've said this before on the show a while ago, that artists, just like in the larger world, beautiful artists do better than less beautiful artists, right? Have you observed that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's almost certainly true. I mean, I don't have any empirical data.
Sure.
I know that there was a study in New York about coming out of the conversation, all the conversations, healthy, painful conversations about the racial, lack of racial in New York. So the city commissioned a study asking, you know, arts organizations, the gender and ethnicity, and a bunch of other questions about their staffs. And it revealed a lot of what you'd think. But they did say, it's almost like a footnote. They said, we were shocked. The most lacking thing, organization reported having a member on staff with a disability.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that said something about how what kind of people have access to these spaces.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the another thing that I held in mind from what you were saying earlier is the bluster and bravado, if I remember right, of the, you know, the artists that do well because this is what collectors want in their artists. This is the image they have of the artist, you know, and that's what they want. It just reminds me of one of the threads that runs throughout your book, which is the way the collector class drives, you know, the conversation, the market, certainly, but maybe as well the conversation. I don't know if you have anything particular that you want to respond to about that.
Well, I mean, I guess, again, I'm working on another book, and another way the conversation developed for me is I think that the conversation about the art market is a dead end. It's a complete dead end. All of the angst about it is totally wasted. The number of artists who that's their thing is a tiny minority and will always be a tiny minority. That's as long as it's a minority that has most of the money. And the real life of the majority of artists is that they work. They're teachers.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the MFA was supposed to be in the first place, the teaching
mm-hmm.
degree.
Right.
Relatively recently that people think of it as a degree that makes you an artist. Or they're designers, or they do all kinds of things, you know, that's real life. And therefore, it just seems to me the much that I guess what I'm saying in relationship to what you just said is that one of the ways that the art collectors distort the conversation about art is that the obsession with them and tends to make everything into a conversation about the market.
Right.
So that even the critical questions, even, you know, the political conversation, the critical question about this focuses on the market. And when a much more important conversation for artists in a way is these bigger questions about, you know, let me put it this way, a city with a much smaller art market, but much cheaper housing would be a better city for artists. I mean, the question of just how expensive it is to live and is in some ways a much more important conversation to artists. And it's also a conversation that has the potential to put artists in the art conversation in solidarity with a much broader political conversation, whereas the art market conversation only ever becomes this kind of jockeying and, you know, angst about who, you know, the bad taste of collectors and so on, you know, the crassness of the art fairs. And that's just, I mean, I have difficulty seeing the kind of broader public getting interested in that conversation in that conversation,
right?
As getting behind that cause, you know, that's just such a I just don't think that reads at all to a kind of broader public you'd need to build solidarity in order to actually improve the lots of artists in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that comes to mind as you say that is it's probably a little easier for you to say that as a on the critic side of the playing field, you know, as opposed to the artist one. You know, the artist, if the artist, I don't know if you had a particular city in mind when you were talking about the city with less of a market but cheaper rent, but the artists don't want to go to... let me see if I can think of a good example. I don't know, Austin or Atlanta, you know, or whatever, because not just because there isn't enough market there, but also because there isn't really enough, you know, peer community there, you know, and so on. Right. So it's always a more complicated question.
The peer community is a different question than, than the market. I mean, I think that in general, yeah, like a place, you know, the cheap space is what creates those kind of communities. You know, I was reading Carolina Miranda's great piece from the LA Times about, you know, the downtown LA art scene in the 70s, I think. And
the glory days.
But I mean, like, you read about that when the sense you get, and you have the same kind of sense is about the East Village or something like that. And these scenes have problems in terms of how artists relate to other communities that they're interweaving with. But you know, the sense you get of like how vital that is, is just so dramatically more than anything. I mean, maybe I just am not invited to the right parties in New York. I'm sure there's all kinds of crazy stuff going on. But, I mean, it doesn't have that feeling. There's no place in New York, I think, right now, has that feeling of just kind of continuous, you know, fuck it, experimentation.
Right.
Everything is very much focused on, like, how do I make a career out of it?
Careerism, yeah.
And if you think about it, I mean, it's just so contrary to all the art that people read about and admire when they become interested in art. It's all of it. What people admire is always like the early scenes, you know, when like almost every art scene that you read about has some passage in the beginning it's almost always identical. It's like this origin, foundational myth of any meaningful historical art scene is there'll be someone who says like, we didn't care about the market. We had nothing to lose. And we were just And therefore, we could try anything. And then this amazing stuff came out of it. I mean, really, anything. You always, you like almost that same sentence over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Which tells, I think that is, you know, that's one of the preconditions for something, for real artistic vitality to emerge.
Doesn't it feel like that's kind of gone the way of, you know, affordable cities, though? You know what I mean? I mean, it feels like a bit of a pipe dream now.
Well, I wrote a piece last year called New York's Art Scene is Doomed. And there is a phenomenon. You know, artists, you can make an incredible case that the most significant artistic invention of the 20th century, this big thing that artists contributed to culture in the 20th century, is the loft. You know, that no one, that was a new thing when artists moved into Soho, and it was this just abandoned light industry. Mm-hmm. And artists started remaking these industrial spaces into the kind of cool places to live. And then now, I think the word Soho loft probably conjures all kinds of horrifying images.
Right.
But there was a whole period of deindustrialization when artists were associated with clustering in central cities. And this pattern developed of kind of creative people being flushed into neighborhoods, real estate developers following them. That's become more and more instrumentalized and woven into the plans of real estate capitalists and government agencies and city policy. I mean, I think Detroit is betting big on luring
right.
artists. There's a famous billboard in the L train here in New York that says, you know, next stop on the L train, Detroit. But the point is that was a certain historic period, and there is the majority of poverty in the United States has migrated to the suburbs, that we passed the point where cities are no longer associated with the same kind of imagery as they were 20 years ago, that they are luxury commodities now, and increasingly new immigrants are settling in suburbs, and you know, the historic communities of color that you associate with the terms inner city are being displaced.
Right.
That's a great clip.
Right.
So, which is something I know you see in LA too. So that means something for where the future of art is. And I would be surprised if in 50 years we looked, you know, the same pattern since the 60s, the Sohoization, Soho effect continued in exactly the same way, because it's just not, there's plenty of cities to move to. But in terms of what you're talking about, was like, where do you find a community, a sustainable community,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't get like gobbled up?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not sure that that's where the future is. I mean, I'd be surprised if it wasn't something like artists taking over abandoned malls or something like that, or living right. in farmhouses.
Right.
If that was the new spatial pattern of artistic development,
mm-hmm.
Richard Florida, the guy who wrote the book, The Rise of the Creative Class, that became mm-hmm. this kind of Bible of gentrification. His new thing is the creative suburb, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like already the theoretical apparatus is already being laid down.
Right. When you talked about the various circumstances that create a successful artist, or that are usually the conditions under which successful artists emerge, I couldn't help but wonder if you feel like the art critic system is a fully meritocratic one, and you know, is much more based on what you write more than anything else, and looks, and you know, and what have you, are irrelevant. Just out of curiosity.
Are you asking me if I got my job because of my looks? No, I mean, the art critic system is fully enmeshed with all the same problems. It has some added problems in that, I mean, I think that artists feel very at the mercy of art critics and pushed around by them because, you know, you spend, I don't know, months, years making something, and then someone can dismiss it in 500 words as nonsense, and that's a very vulnerable position to be in. But you got to understand that the writers are, by definition, a secondary function to the art.
Right.
And because of that, it's a thinner scene. There are less writers than there are artists. And there's, you know, there aren't that many, if you were looking to like aspire to be like who are the big, successes. I mean, your role models would be your models of success, professional success. Your models would be like few and far between.
Sure.
As an art critic. It has a lot of the same distortions with different kind of local kind of interesting patterns that are interesting to analyze.
Yeah. I've asked this question of other critics or writers art writers I've spoken to. Do you ever get together and you know, I think I actually Andrew Russeth, do you ever get together, you know, the group of you critics and you know, and just hang out, just the critics at the bar?
Well, not just the critics, because a lot of critics hate each other, but I mean, I hang out, I see you know, there's an art writer scene in New York. I have many more writer friends than I have artist friends. And you know, in a way, it's been an interesting moment, because this is the first wave of people who've grown up as writers, developed as writers on the internet.
Right.
And, that's created completely new. Like I was talking earlier about, you know, there are different art scenes that you walk into, with people who have different coordinates and yeah, there's just a whole, there's an online art writing world that exists in a complete, it's like a bizarro world version of the print scene. You know, they move in and out of each other, but they're very distinct.
Mm.
And a lot of those writers, I mean, I was editor of a website called Art Info for a long time. And a lot of writers pass through there. So that, you know, there's a constellation of people that, have shared experiences.
Right. When you talked about print, you know, the print worlds and the sort of online worlds and sort of how they kind of move in and out of each other, I thought of Art Forum, first of all, and then I thought of an earlier question or point that I wanted to make with you, which is, here in L.A., as you may or may not know, the Los Angeles Times art reviews hold enormous sway as far as galleries are concerned. You know, it's like this is the stamp of approval. And so A, I guess I want to see if you have any thoughts on that. I mean, I find it tremendously problematic because, I mean, one gallerist in particular that I've spoken to is like, you know, he sends all of his people and potential collectors, you know, these great reviews. But as soon as there's a bad review, you know, it's like, get that thing out of the way. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But also, just to sort of tail onto that point, art forum, you know, just still has this tremendous influence, particularly, you know, alone just with their advertising. You know, it's like before people go anywhere else, they're going to go to Art Forum and put that gallery ad in. So you can take that wherever you will.
Yeah, like business if you can get it.
Yeah, exactly.
People read you for the ad.
Right.
But what is it that you find problematic? You find it problematic just the fact that people take the LA Times seriously? Because that to me seems like, as a writer, I'm like, I'm glad, you know, writers complain all the time that like the negative reviews don't matter anymore. And it's the market has replaced the critic as the arbiter of taste.
No. The thing that I find problematic, and you can argue against me if you don't feel it's problematic, is that the dominance, the degree to which the power is subsumed into four critics, you know, of this one institution, when you have all these other, you know, places where writing can appear, but they're virtually invisible.
Well, I mean, I would say I do have thoughts about that. I would say two things. One is, I believe, and I maybe flatter myself into thinking that this is part of the success of my book, but I believe that there's a tremendous void right now in terms of ideas, that it can't just be that people are just making stuff because they want to make stuff. Like, I mean, people are really hungry for narratives to place this in place these things inside, you know, and to think about these things as socially meaningful, as different from other things that have come before, and that those are things that, you know, the writing about it and ideas help shape. I think the internet art writing culture has opened up a huge space for new voices. And I make it a point to kind of read the best out there every month. And there's some really good, you know, there's exciting venues and stuff. I'd say that there's less, one of the effects of the internet, however, is that it's very personalistic.
Right.
You know, if you look at what a blog is, it's like an individual voice. So it tends to throw things back away from the art forum model, which is almost disembodied and, you know, completely like reading a college term paper, mm-hmm. Aspires to be like reading a college term paper, to a kind of very personal focused response to things. Unfortunately, that's the generalization, but unfortunately I think that describes a lot of stuff out there, and it's not enough, you know, the thing is, I think that's part of the hold that the institutions still have, is that their historical prestige stands in for like a big narrative, you know, the time, like you're part of the big narrative of having been reviewed in the LA Times. So I think there's that. And so I think that, you know, there's a big opportunity to just find new ideas that are relevant to the conversation people are having, and make one's mark out there. And then the other thing I'd say is that, I don't know, have you been to the Artist Book Fair?
Popular.
Yes, it's so popular. And to me, when I look at that, and part of what I see there is that, is this exciting, that there's not enough writing, mm-hmm. you know, that people, and so artists are making their own, you know, and finding ways to produce an art discourse around their work through artist publications, which maybe that might be a lot more wholesome than some new new institutional publication. I consider the Artist Book Fair actually a little ray of hope. You know, I find it very exciting, the energy around it.
I think, to your point about the online, you know, having potential and whatnot. I mean, I think our, New York already seems to have, I mean, several sources that are being consumed and integrated, I should say, into the gallery's portfolios. You know, they're including ArtNet News, Hyperlurgic, ArtF City, you know, a couple of others, mm-hmm. right? But here, it seems yet to have happened. You know, it's just, you know, there are a couple of magazines, other, you know, the local magazines, you know, but that there's the LA Times, and there are no online only publications that have made any impact whatsoever out here.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I don't know what the future of art publishing is going to be. There has to be one, in the sense that, like, Lawrence Alloway has this great line where he says that, you know, an art world is circulation of discourse, circulation of art. It's not production of art. You can have lots of art produced in a place mm-hmm. with no art world. Mm-hmm. So there's no conversation about it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go anywhere. It's not shown. So it's the institutions of circulation, you know, your galleries, your museums, but importantly, yeah, the writing about it that makes an art world. And, you know, without the writing about it, without the kind of intellectual circulation around it, then it's just an overpriced piece of decoration. So, there's this huge interest in maintaining that. It's not clear to me that anyone wants to fund it. The art industry is definitely not immune to all the shakeout in the publishing industry. But you know, I don't, it just seems to me like such an, you know, if that doesn't exist in Los Angeles already, it seems to me like such a hole, to fill.
Yeah. I mean, I think your point about if it doesn't have that conversation, that dialogue, it's just, you know, overpriced decoration. I think that people should be more, in light of that, people should be more grateful for the array of publications that are out there, you know, that may not be being appropriated for galleries' press materials here in L.A., but they do exist and people consume them. For sure. And they're being talked about. So people should be grateful for them.
Yeah, well, you've got some amazing art writers. So, yeah, I hope that people appreciate them. I stick up for my tribe.
Well, Ben, I think I should let you get to bed probably, huh? I know you're a night owl,
sure.
But...
Well, tomorrow's a working day. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. Well, you know, it's been an honor chatting with you, and I really appreciate you you making the time, a lot of time.
Yeah, it's much appreciated, and keep me posted.
Absolutely.